Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, earlier on during the festive period, you might have heard our review of 2017 in film, books and music. Well, today at the top of a brand new year, we're going to look ahead to what we might be listening to, watching and reading over the coming months. The guests who gave us their top picks of last year had such good taste that we reckon they've got their finger on the pulse of 2018 and therefore we've invited them back. Those people are the broadcaster and DJ Georgie Rogers, the publisher at Unbound, John Mitchinson, and the film critic for the Daily Telegraph, Tim Robey. Welcome back. Happy New Year, all of you. How was Christmas?
Amazing.
A delight. We spent it here. It was so great.
Thank you, Monocle.
No one's...
Thank you, Monocle,
for amazing suite.
Applying the padlock to Studio 2 door.
Hospitality. It's good as hair.
Everything, all your turkey treats come on a small wooden platter. It's good, isn't it? Okay, so we're gonna swap things up from last time round. Who knows? We're gonna put our hands in the Scrabble bag and pull out a figure, and that is Georgie Rogers. We're gonna start with you, Georgie. We've got music. Where are we going in 2018 with a world of riches ahead of us? Where on earth are we gonna stick the pin?
Well, let's start with Nils Fram. I think
why the big take a breath there?
I took the breath because I have to take a moment to just whoa how gushy I might get of this, because I'm a huge Nils Fram fan. He's a Berlin-based artist. He's kind of like a modern-day classical virtuoso, and all his music is a sublime fusion of classical music, jazz, classical piano, jazz, and electronic music. It's just he's just amazing. He's got a new album. So I was looking ahead. I was like, oh, what albums are coming up next year? And then my jaw was on the floor. So I was like, oh, Nils Fram has released an album in January. Yeah, I've been waiting for this since Spaces, which was genuinely
a
masterpiece.
Record.
Yeah. So this is his 9th studio album. I've had to listen to the whole thing on repeat numerous times. Basically obsessed with it.
Should we let the cat out of the bag for our listeners?
Yeah.
So, because Nils Fram might not be a name that everyone is familiar with. Let's have a clip. This is All Melody. A reflective tone, that is a slice of All Melody. It's coming up this month in January from Nils Fram. So it's a difficult thing to do as a recording artist, maybe to straddle that kind of contemporary, classical, ambient, electronic thing. What, in the days of record shops, what pigeonhole would you put him in so that customers could find Nils Fram, I wonder?
Well, that's the thing. I think, I mean, you can't really necessarily lump him in because there's so much of the classical piano in there. There's so much of the jazz and there's so much of the electronic. In terms of the instruments he's using in the mix in this, there's organs, there's pan pipes, there's trumpets, electronics, progressive house, techno kind of synths, drum machines, strings, with the classical piano over the top. And on this album, it sort of feels like he's kind of expanding his palette even more. I interviewed him once and he said he kind of feels sad when a record is finished because he improvises so much and he changes things up and he's, you know, it's just such a free-flowing thing for him that actually having a finite thing makes him kind of a bit sad. And I was like, wow, that's interesting to hear you say that.
Yeah.
But for people that love his work, having a finite thing, I listened to that Spaces album. I can't even. I listened to it so much, and I'm going
to
be doing exactly the same.
It's difficult to pin
down
that kind of music, isn't it? As well, because you can't. Because it's not necessarily. Although this record is perhaps teasingly called All Melody.
Yeah.
There is something about that kind of thing which is very spacious. It kind of allows your mind to fill in the gaps or something, rather than it being, you know, 12 3-minute pop songs. Clearly that's not his game.
No.
How do you what mood do you have to be in to listen to that, or does it put you in the mood that you find the record makes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you can't mess about with this. You've got to listen to it on a good sound system. A lot of the tracks are kind of 7, 8, 9 minute epic soundscapes. What you heard there doesn't really do it justice in terms of the variation on this. He basically got a new studio in Berlin, spent 2 years deconstructing and rebuilding it, and then he built a pipe organ into the studio and created a mixing desk. He's also used kind of choral vocals in this from children. So what he did, Girls and Boys, like Human Voices, which he's then cut up, and then he's turned the pipe organ into a drum machine. And it kind of blew my mind when I heard this
sounds
album.
Sounds like there is a good story to be done on Nils' studio in Berlin.
There's like the beautiful, soft, classical bits, and then there's the electronic behemoths that just you kind of fill your brain with sounds. And then there's also quite a, like an intimate approach with the recording. At times you can even hear the hands on the keys and him tinkling the old ivories. And when you see him live, he's going to be touring this. He's announced a big world tour. He plays with one shoe on.
I'm so glad you love this kind of stuff, because I love this kind of stuff so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's
obviously, you need to play with one shoe.
Sounds up my street.
Yeah. John's narrowing his eyes and yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like some sort of mad kind of collision between Andrew Weatherall and Eno.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like seeing him live is genuinely a magical, transformative experience. I've seen him live a few times now. And this album, sorry, but you feel reborn after it. Like, I felt reborn. I listened to it on a plane.
You're a newborn
to Madrid.
Child. Wow.
Yeah, and I felt reborn.
Fight and talk.
Yeah,
between
it's fight and talk.
I did.
It makes you. It's called All Melody. It's out this month. New from Nils Frahm. We have a little bit to go on. Georgie Rodgers. It makes a lot.
Bit
in Georgie Rodgers in the Rodgers household. It makes you at least feel like you're wearing two shoes. Okay, let's switch it up. Let's have a clip from Georgie's second choice. This is Negative Space. New from Hookworms. New from Hookworms, that is a single from the upcoming album. It's called Negative Space. The album's going to be called Microshift. Tell us about these guys, Georgie.
So this is their third album. They're a band from Leeds. And it's been about 3 years since their last record. On the past two, it's been much more informed by the live sound. So a little bit more raw and kind of haphazard in a good way. But just a little bit more kind of wild, I suppose. But this one, the studio was central to its creation. It was kind of born in the studio, formed of loops and modular synthesizer sequences and drum machines and sample that they then made and layered. So you kind of get this euphoric fusion, as you may have heard on that track.
There's a bit of Primal Scream. There's quite a lot of Primal Scream going on.
Yeah,
there,
like driving guitars and beats and synths and drum machines all kind of working at the same time and loads of layers to quite a exhilarating end, I think. Like lyrically and stuff, this album covers death, disease, heartbreak, body image, natural disaster as well. MJ is in the band and he has a home studio, and it's actually kind of a mainstay for quite a lot of the new bands coming up through the Leeds scene. There's a good band called Drayler who worked with him there, and it had to be restored after a flood. So there's a bit of, you know, that in there.
What about, so when people are riffing off their live sound and kind of taking it into any old studio and then they kind of do a studio album, does that kind of have difficult second album syndrome? Does that have like the kind of like the live punky kind of stuff that you can just put in a bottle and take the top off and you get something kind of vibey? What happens when you make a studio album? I get a bit of Let It Be syndrome where no one likes each other and they've spent too much time together. That doesn't come out on this record, or do we see a little bit more complication?
No, I think if anything, it's probably just made them a bit more focused.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine live, this album comes alive. There are so many strong tracks on it, you know, listening through, and it feels quite free and like it was a positive experience. But you can never, you can't necessarily tell, can you, when listening to a record, or that they hated each other and that was an awful experience.
No, indeed. I mean, Fleetwood Mac has such good harmonies.
Yeah,
you would never know.
Yeah.
What about, so when you make a live, also when you cut records off your live stuff, and then you make an album in the studio and then you take it out on the road. This presumably is expected that they'll tour well with an album like this, a bigger record. They're on Domino Records, quite a big or decent, well-respected indie label. How does that work? Do you think this is an album that was made to take out on the road rather than the product of stuff on the road?
Definitely. There's tracks on this album that you would absolutely love to be dancing around a club show to, or even a bigger show or at a festival. And I think that's where it really will come into its own. I mean, it sounds great on record, but definitely in the live space, I think it'll be definitely like one of those bands to go and see. And I think these kinds of bands, we need to kind of love them and nurture them and champion them, because, you know, with lots of bands that are getting through to the third, fourth, fifth albums, you know, you've seen it, Maccabees and Wild Beasts split up this year, and bands that are using guitars and you know, creating this kind of sound, I do feel like we just need to kind of go, yay, you know, you're still doing it. Because it's hard. Yeah. They're not making any money.
Yeah, exactly. And you knew there was a lead scene?
Yeah.
It's Microshift. It's going to be out on February the 2nd on Domino Records. The band are Hookworms. Before that, Georgie was telling us about the new Nils Frahm LP out on his own, I think, Erase Tapes. Label.
He's with Erase Tapes, which is a label looks after.
Out on the 26th of Jan, Nils Frahm. Okay, it's books time now. John, this is an interesting one. It's new from Dave Eggers.
Yes.
See, I, in doing my research for this, presume this was fiction, but it's not. It's called The Monk of Mocha. Talk us through this one.
Well, from the publisher's mouth, and I have to confess, I've only had they haven't released even a proof of it yet. Dave Eggers is obviously major American writer. His great memoir, which was a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, which was more than 10 years ago now, which seems incredible, and has published as sort of different styles of books. He does big novels like The Circle, which is a dystopian fantasy set in Silicon Valley, which is a couple of years ago. And then he does a sort of odd non-fiction projects, which are stories about characters often in extreme or difficult circumstances. The one that most resembles The Monk of Mocha is Zaytun, which was a kind of an Arabic American paddling around trying to help people after Katrina, and he ends up getting pulled in by the state police and ends up being imprisoned, and it's his story of how his family fought to get him out. So he does this kind of very fiction, faction, you're never quite sure whether it's a true story or not a true story.
And Dave Eggers, I suppose, obviously has his books, he has his publisher, he also has the Believer magazine, which is a kind of portal for this stuff.
He is kind of just one of the great good guys of American letters, I think, and he's also a hell of a good writer. And I have to say, the premise of this book is brilliant. He takes a young Yemeni American who's fascinated by the history of coffee, and he goes back to the Yemen and goes back up into the hill villages. He's determined to build a sort of American dream novel, a kind of rival to Starbucks using Yemeni coffee. And being an Eggers novel, you get a whole load of information about the history of coffee and the different varieties of coffee beans and why Yemeni coffee is so interesting. That's all going well. He's organized the farmers. He's getting sort of properly entrepreneurial. And then civil war kind of takes over, and the whole of the Yemen goes into. So then Eggers, the kind of social commentator, the person who's trying to sort of throw light on cultural atrocities that most Americans don't know, takes over, and he's trying to get back to America, which he does. And then the book sort of switches again into the history of how do you build a successful kind of coffee brand in America and what are the moral implications of that. So it's a fair
if not a multi, then at least a triple faceted.
Yeah.
This is like a sort of, this is like a very long New Yorker story on steroids kind of thing.
I guess so. And it's very, very unlike that. He published a book earlier in 2017, Heroes of the Frontier, which was about a woman with two small kids whose marriage had broken down, who she decides she's going to take them, puts them in an RV and drives to live in Alaska in the wilderness. Again, beautifully told, great characters, fantastic contrast between the mother's experiences and the developing kind of awareness of the two young children. I mean, the thing about Eggers, you never feel that you're not in the hands of somebody who doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, that's
really
an important
really
thing when something takes you down so many kind of loops and tunnels and not spurious areas of interest, but extracurricular for the story areas of interest.
Well, I like the way he does that. I like the way he goes to Silicon Valley, or he picks the story of a suburban woman, or he finds a kind of a young hero like in the Monk of Mocha, and he takes them and he gets inside the character, and then he tells a story. And he tells a story with a kind of the authenticity of sort of nonfiction. You feel that it's like a sort of, in a way, he's almost become like an oral historian, a sort of Studs Terkel, telling. He's very good at ventriloquizing. I mean, it's you don't want to use the word ordinary people, but the kind of people who don't often get a kind of a go in fiction.
Yeah.
And he does that, I think, better than any other of his American contemporaries.
This is an odd one, but you know how I always think about if your favourite authors were still around today, what would they be doing? Is there a subject that you'd like? Well, I always kind of wish that J.G. Ballard had ended up moving to Dubai before he died and things like that. You know what I mean? I love that part of the world to be nailed by someone.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that actually Ballard is a really interesting comparison because, you know, in the way that Ballard was obsessed with kind of the end of kind of consumerist culture and post-consumerist culture and was obsessed with that paradox. He really quite liked going to the south of Spain, but also could see that it was, I mean, you know, everything that's happened in Marbella, you can see that was already sort of pre-scripted in the Ballard novels that were written 15-20 years ago.
He's drawn to apocalypse, Ballard. He seems like it in a way.
Yeah. The empty swimming pool. I mean, I think Eggers, absolutely, you'd want to put Eggers.
I wonder where you'd want to, as someone that knows his writing very well, where you'd want to see him report from. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess you want to see him do sort of a month in the White House or something. Obviously, but
funnily enough, coming this year, the big book of this next year, which is just almost too ghastly to contemplate, is a collaboration. It's called "The President Is Missing," and it's a collaboration between Bill Clinton and Robert Pattinson, the great, our Patsy.
Robert Pattinson or James Pattinson?
James.
J-Pats. But we mean J-Pats.
Wow.
James Pattinson. James Pattinson. That would have been a much bigger story.
That would have been amazing.
But and apparently the plot is the president has gone missing. And apparently they've been on tours together, Clinton and Pattinson. So Pattinson is extraordinary because he's like I'm slightly off script now, obviously, but he's like, he has an atelier of mini Pattinson's writing. I mean, he can publish more books than anybody else.
I have read one of his novels and it's one of the worst books I've ever read. Along Came a Spider is one of the worst written novels I've ever read.
Well, he just outsources it now. But that's going to be the big... So, yeah, I'd be much... I mean, the idea of Trump going missing is that something...
Or the idea of
Eggers kind of in the White House.
Yeah.
It would be fun, yeah.
And for the time being, though, it's The Monk of Mocha by Dave Eggers. John, your second choice is Sight, which is a debut novel from Jesse Greengrass.
Could not be more different.
Who is a name perhaps unknown around this table and to our listeners. So tell us about Jesse.
Jesse Greengrass is 30, and she's published one collection of stories before. In my view, it was, probably the best. I mean, it's interesting. There have been two or three or possibly even four really amazing debut short story collections by women in the last 18 months, of which an account of the decline of the great orc according to one who saw it by Jesse Greengrass was one. And this was a really strange and kind of affecting collection of short stories, mostly historical, mostly to do with isolation, quite a lot of them set at sea.
But sort of St Kilda vibe.
St Kilda is exactly right. It's sort of north and kind of damp. And anyway, this is the first novel. And there were the other people I put in that bracket. There was a wonderful Claire Louise Bennett's Pond, which was a wonderful collection. Ellie Williams' A Trib, very jokey, clever. But it feels like a bit of a scene. Joanna Walsh, another. One, that short stories are sort of not dead, which is great because they're buried every generation by somebody. Two, that some of them are beginning to also write novels, which is not a requirement. Helen Simpson's never published a novel. She's a brilliant short story writer. But this Sight is a novel, and she's nailed it. I mean, I think trepidation always when a short story writer who is young tries to take on a novel. It's not got a massive amount of plot.
It's got a very interesting premise. It's about psychoanalysis. It's about motherhood.
It is about motherhood. It's about a woman who's got a small child and is pregnant with a second, whose mother has recently died, and it's her recollections of her time with her mother, but also about her grandmother, who was a psychoanalyst, and woven into the plot, the sight, trying to see her mother as a person rather than just a mother, and trying to understand and put together the intergenerational relationships had worked. But threaded into all this, there's the story of Sight being the kind of the theme that runs through it. Roncheon's discovery of X-ray. There's wonderful sort of digressions into Sigmund Freud and his daughter Anna, that their kind of intergenerational, the invention of psychoanalysis. So sight, insight. I mean, just for prose alone, it's beautiful to read. And you, again, for somebody who is relatively young, you feel you're in a kind of Nabokovian world. She studied philosophy at university, and this is, there have been philosophical books about motherhood, Rachel Cusgrove, but I think this is, there's something about the tone of this. She's got that sort of salty, kind of slightly melancholy feel that the first book had. But it's incredibly wise and insightful all the way through about what it's like to have, you know, to become a mother, to be creating life, and to the changes that it forces on you. There seem to be a lot of British young women writers who are doing really interesting things, who are prepared to be a bit experimental, who aren't just writing. I mean, this you might say, oh, an English young English writer writes about motherhood. Well, it's as far away from feeling like that as you could imagine. I mean, it's I'm speaking as somebody, you know, who is not young or about to give birth. I found it completely compelling. I mean, having loved the first collection, you know, as I say, it's amazing that you can get something. This is as good, if not better, I think.
It is Sight. It's the debut. It's the debut novel from Jesse Greengrass. Before that, John Cho's The Monk of Mocha, which is coming up from Dave Eggers. Thank you very much, John. Amazing choices. And we're going to the land of film. Tim Robey, welcome back.
Hi.
Under your hat, you're holding You Were Never Really Here, which is Lynn Ramsey's new film. Why don't we hear a clip? Let's get into a filmic mood with a clip.
You have kids, Joe? Nina. Her name is Nina. 235 East 31st Street. I've heard of these places.
If she's there, I'll get her.
Cleary said you were brutal.
I can be.
New from Lynn Ramsey, as chosen by Tim Robey, is called You Were Never Really Here. Whackin' Phoenix, Lynn Ramsey. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, I love Lynn Ramsey's films. She hasn't made one since We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's a genre film of a kind. I would describe it as kind of like an anti-thriller. It's very harrowing and quite a hard sell in some ways. I'm going to kind of explain how harrowing it is first before I try and give it the sell it needs, because it is one of the most exhilarating pieces of filmmaking I've seen in a long time. Joaquin Phoenix's character is a sort of mercenary. He used to be his Gulf War veteran and worked for the FBI. But now he's employed as a kind of mercenary in the worst job imaginable, which is he's extracting children from sex rings. He's employed by their parents to go in there and extract teenagers from sex rings.
So he's like a private contractor.
Exactly. Right. So what it conjures is shades of Taxi Driver, really, because the kind of guy he's playing is a bit like Travis Bickle. He is disturbed in his own way. He's sent in and, you know, horrendous situations ensue. Now, it's a very violent film up to a point, but Lynn Ramsey's control of the material is so strong that she manages to kind of insinuate violence almost all the way through without, well, barely showing any. She shows the absolute bare minimum. It's cut down to the like with a razor, this film, to the absolute bare minimum shards of what you need to see. Incredibly, it's 85 minutes long. It's a really short film. It packs in an enormous amount of plot, and it has absolutely extraordinary craft to it. I can get Georgie on board here because Johnny Greenwood did the score, and it is one of his great scores. It pulsates underneath the film and just gives you this kind of sense of dread coming through every sequence. Not an easy watch by any means, but I think it just proves yet again that Lynn Ramsey, ever since her debut Ratcatcher and Morven Callor, and we need to talk about Kevin, she's been one of our great filmmakers.
Yeah, and all uncomfortable stuff. I mean, this seems like very much of a piece with her other, with and also with the subject matter.
I think it's very clear that Lynn Ramsey will never make a rom-com. and this is definitely not that film. I need to talk about Joaquin, because he is absolutely remarkable in it. He's almost unrecognisable underneath this big, great big beard, this big grey beard. He looks about twice as old as he looked the last time you saw him, basically. And he's carrying around the weight of this job with him. I think he's absolutely mesmerizing in it. And it's a very subtle performance. You never feel as though he's kind of grandstanding. It's very, very subtle. And there's some extraordinary moments of humor in this film, too. There's a bit where this sort of, what's that famous Charlene song called? It will come back to me. Playing over the top of the scene, and you find him holding hands with this character you would never really... I mean, one of his mortal enemies during this sequence. It's a scene that will kind of go down in legend. It's not out till April. It actually premiered back in Venice, I think, back in September, but they're holding on to it. It's something really quite special, I think.
So this is a post-awards thing then, really. So it gets all that stuff out of the way, and then we go into a whole, in terms of film critics and the industry and the rest of it, we go, after April, we go into a whole new kind of season, don't we?
That's right, yeah. And I mean, I feel as though it's one of Joaquin Phoenix's great performances, but whether the film is just a bit too much for you know, Oscar voters, that's possible. I mean, it is tough.
And this, as I said, this is thematically, or in terms of the subject matter, anyway, this seems very much on a par with Lynn Ramsey's other stuff. Is this something that is this a short story? Is this a novel?
It's based on a novella by Jonathan Ames, which is a very hard boiled novella, which I think another director could have adapted in a completely different way and made it more thrillerish in a way, and made it more kind of more catharsis out of the material, giving you satisfaction. She completely withholds that. It's an incredibly kind of morally rigorous experience, because we're not meant to be having fun during these scenes in any way. And it's not kick-ass stuff. It's not, you know, kind of it's not like, oh boy, let's kind of go in there and have some crazy ultra-violence. It's really, it withdraws all of that from you. You get none of that satisfaction. A lot of the stuff going on is happening off-screen, and you only see the consequences later. And I think she's just got such control over it at this point. She just gets better and better. I swear to you, if Martin Scorsese had adapted this book, he would have made it a 3-hour film.
Yeah.
And Lynn Ramsey's made it 85 minutes.
Good for Lynn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's You Were Never Really Here, starring Joaquin Phoenix. It is new. It's out in April. You'll have to wait until then, I'm afraid. It is new, though, from Lynn Ramsey. Always worth waiting around for. We're going to finish off with Annihilation, Tim.
I have less to say about Annihilation, only because I haven't seen it.
Annihilation, no one good. Has. Second door on the left. Yeah. So this is Alex Garland. It started off as a great writer, and now this is purely a directorial film.
He's moved into directing. So before it was a film, Annihilation was a book as well.
Not by him, but
by a guy called Jeff Vandermeer. Yes, it's the first one of his Southern Reach trilogy. Yeah. Which John can probably tell me more about than I know, because I haven't read them.
No, he's kind of the cutting edge of kind of intelligent, dark, dystopian American fantasy. So I haven't read them either. But
I
know lots of people who have and love him.
Yes, exactly. People are really excited about these books, and I think they were even more excited when they heard that Alex Garland was going to adapt it as his follow-up to Ex Machina, which is his debut science fiction film a couple of years ago.
Should we have a clip of this so that we're feeling the vibe before we head off?
Did your husband contact you at any point while he was away?
No.
It was his decision to go in.
Why did my husband volunteer for a suicide mission? You have to tell me where he was, what he was doing. I need to know what's inside. I could save him.
Okay, that was a clip of Annihilation, new from Alex Garland. Most of the voices you heard there were Natalie Portman, who stars in this one. And that looks like sort of people going away. They have an experience in the dark, deep, dark forest, but sort of sci-fi fantasy experience of some sort.
It's a genre film of a very different ilk from Lynn Ramsey's. I'm excited by the cast, because Natalie Portman is this biologist who's lost her husband, played by Oscar Isaac, in some sort of environmental disaster zone, and goes in to try and figure out what's happened. It's opening in February, but still hasn't been screened, and people are really excited about it. The trailer is excellent. He's working on a bigger budget this time than Ex Machina, but he's using the same effects team. Actually, one of them is a friend of mine who won an Oscar for Ex Machina, and extraordinarily on that sort of low-budget film, beating Star Wars, beating Mad Max. They won the Best Visual Effects Oscar, and they're back on this one.
What's the vibe for those visual effects? Is that something where you kind of make the most of, or you make a virtue of your lack of huge budget?
Well,
somehow?
I think, I mean...
Because this doesn't look sci-fi, this looks just unnerving.
It looks unnerving, and the trailers try not to give away too many of the kind of effect moments, because obviously there's some horrors lying in wait. I'm well up for this kind of film when it's done well, and I feel lately we haven't been given the best examples of this genre by Ridley Scott with Prometheus and Alien Covenant, and everyone's sort of hoping that this is the good one, and my fingers are very much crossed.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much indeed, Tim, for your film choices. Thank you also to my other guests today, Georgie Rogers and John Mitchinson. That brings us to the end of the show. My producer was, of course, Holly Fisher. To play us out today, let's have a new track by US Girls, whose upcoming album I've been very much looking forward to for a while. We'll be back at the same time, same place next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and this is Velvet for Sale.